Chapter 5. The Wind of Hate. Hate and Trauma in Our Daily Lives. When we consider the matter, are we truly surprised to discover that it is not danger that causes psychiatric stress? And is the existence of an intense resistance to participating in aggressive situations really so unexpected? To a large extent, our society, particularly our young men, actively and vicariously pursues physical danger. Through roller coasters, action and horror movies, drugs, rock climbing, whitewater rafting, scuba diving, parachuting, hunting, contact sports, and 100 other methods, our society enjoys danger. To be sure, danger in excess grows old fast, particularly when we feel that we have lost control of it. And the potential for death and injury is an important ingredient in the complex mixture that makes combat so stressful. But it is not the major cause of stress in either our daily lives or in combat. But facing aggression and hatred in our fellow citizens is an experience of an entirely different magnitude. All of us have had to face hostile aggression, on the playground as children, in the impoliteness of strangers, in the malicious gossip and comments of acquaintances, and in the animosity of peers and superiors in the workplace. In all these instances, everyone has known hostility and the stress it can cause. Most avoid confrontation at all costs, and to work ourselves up to an aggressive verbal action, let alone a physical confrontation, is extremely difficult. Simply confronting the boss about a promotion or a raise is one of the most stressful and upsetting things most people can never bring themselves to do, and many never even get that far. Facing down the school bully or confronting a hostile acquaintance is something that most will avoid at all costs. Many medical authorities believe that it is the constant hostility and lack of acceptance that they must face and the resulting stress that are responsible for the dramatic rate of high blood pressure in African Americans. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, the Bible of Psychology, states that in post-traumatic stress disorders, the disorder may be especially severe or longer lasting when the stressor is of human design. We want desperately to be liked, loved, and in control of our lives. And intentional, overt human hostility and aggression, more than anything else in life, assaults our self-image, our sense of control, our sense of the world as a meaningful and comprehensible place, and, ultimately, our mental and physical health. The ultimate fear and horror in most modern lives is to be raped or beaten, to be physically degraded in front of our loved ones, to have our family harmed and the sanctity of our homes invaded by aggressive and hateful intruders. Death or debilitation by disease and accident are statistically far more likely to occur than death or debilitation by malicious action. But the statistics do not calm our basically irrational fears. It is not fear of death and injury from disease or accident, but rather acts of personal depredation and domination by our fellow human beings that strike terror and loathing in our hearts. In rape, the psychological harm usually far exceeds the physical injury. The trauma of rape, like that of combat, involves minimal fear of death or injury. Far more damaging is the impotence, shock, and horror in being so hated and despised as to be debased and abused by a fellow human being. The average citizen resists engaging in aggressive and assertive activities and dreads facing the irrational aggression and hatred of others. The soldier in combat is no different. He resists the powerful obligation and coercion to engage in aggressive and assertive actions on the battlefield, and he dreads facing the irrational aggression and hostility embodied in the enemy. Indeed, history is full of tales of soldiers who have committed suicide or inflicted terrible wounds upon themselves to avoid combat. It isn't fear of death that motivates these men to kill themselves. Like many of their civilian counterparts who commit suicide, these men would rather die or mutilate themselves than face the aggression and hostility of a very hostile world. The impact of hate in Nazi death camps. Quote, an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal behavior. Viktor Frankl, Nazi concentration camp survivor. Perhaps a deeper understanding of the power of the buffeting of hate can be obtained from a study of survivors of Nazi concentration camps. Even the briefest review of available literature reveals that these individuals did suffer from great, lifelong psychological damage as a result of their experiences in concentration camps. even though they did not have any obligation or ability to kill their tormentors. Among civilian victims, POWs under artillery fire, sailors in naval combat, and soldiers on patrols behind enemy lines, we do not find any large-scale incidents of psychiatric casualties. But in such places as Dachau and Auschwitz, they were the rule rather than the exception. This is one historical circumstance in which noncombatants did suffer a horrifyingly high incidence of psychiatric casualties and post-traumatic stress. Physical exhaustion is not the only or even the primary factor involved here, and neither is the horror of the death and destruction around them principally responsible for the psychic shock of this situation. The distinguishing characteristic here, as opposed to numerous other noncombatant circumstances marked by an absence of psychiatric casualties, is that those in concentration camps had to face aggression and death on a highly personal face-to-face basis. Nazi Germany placed a remarkable concentration of aggressive psychopaths in charge of these camps, and the lives of these victims were completely dominated by the personalities of these terrifyingly brutal individuals. Dyer tells us that concentration camps were staffed whenever possible with both male and female thugs and sadists. Unlike the victims of aerial bombing, the victims of these camps had to look their sadistic killers in the face and know that another human being denied their humanity and hated them enough to personally slaughter them, their families, and their race, as though they were nothing more than animals. During strategic bombing, the pilots and bombardiers were protected by distance and could deny to themselves that they were attempting to kill any specific individual. In the same way, civilian bombing victims were protected by distance, and they could deny that anyone was personally trying to kill them. And among POWs who were subjected to bombing, as stated earlier, the bombs were not personal, and the guards were no threat to the POWs as long as they played by the rules. But in the death camps, it was starkly, horribly personal. Victims of this horror had to look the darkest and most loathsome deaths of human hatred in the eye. There was no room for denial, and the only escape was more madness. It is here, in this sordid account of man's inhumanity to man, that we see the flip side of the aversion to killing in combat. Not only does the average soldier's psyche resist killing and the obligation to kill, but he is equally horrified when exposed to the aggression of an enemy who hates him and denies his humanity enough to kill him. The soldier's response to the overtly hostile actions of the enemy is usually one of profound shock, surprise, and outrage. Countless veterans echo novelist and Vietnam veteran Philip Caputo's first reaction to enemy fire in Vietnam. "Why does he want to kill me?" thought Caputo. "What did I ever do to him?" One Vietnam-era pilot told me that he was largely undisturbed by the impersonal flak around him, but he was memorably disturbed when he once focused on one lone enemy soldier standing casually next to his hooch, carefully firing up at me. It was one of the rare times he had ever been able to distinguish an individual enemy soldier, and his immediate reaction was an indignant, "What did I ever do to him?" Then came a hurt and angry, "I do not like you, Sam, I am. I do not like you one damn bit." And he then directed all the resources and assets of his aircraft to kill this one individual and blow up his little hooch. An application. Attrition versus maneuver warfare. In the field of strategy and tactics, the impact and influence of the wind of hate has been widely overlooked. Numerous tacticians and strategists advocate attrition warfare theories, in which the will of enemy forces is destroyed through the application of long-range artillery and bombing. The advocates of such theories persist in their beliefs, even in the face of evidence, such as the post-World War II U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, which, in the words of Paul Fussell, ascertained that German military and industrial production seemed to increase, just like civilian determination not to surrender, the more bombs were dropped. Psychologically, aerial and artillery bombardments are effective, but only in the front lines, where they are combined with the wind of hate, as manifested in the threat of the personal infantry attack that usually follows such bombardments. This is why there were mass psychiatric casualties following World War I artillery bombardments. But World War II's mass bombing of cities were surprisingly counterproductive in breaking the enemy's will. Such bombardments, without an accompanying close-range assault, or at least the threat of such an assault, are ineffective and may even serve no other purpose than to stiffen the will and resolve of the enemy. Today, a few pioneering authors, such as William Lind and Robert Linnert, have focused their research and writings on the field of maneuver warfare, in which they attempt to refute the advocates of attrition warfare and understand the process of destroying the enemy's will to fight rather than his ability to fight. What maneuver warfare advocates have discovered is that over and over in history, civilians and soldiers have withstood the actuality of fear, horror, death, and destruction during artillery bombardments and aerial bombardments without losing their will to fight, while the mere threat of invasion and close-up interpersonal aggression has consistently turned whole populations into refugees fleeing in panic. This is why putting unfriendly troop units in the enemy's rear is infinitely more important and effective than even the most comprehensive bombardments in his rear or attrition along his front. We saw this in the Korean War, in which during the early years of the war, the rate of psychiatric casualties was almost 7 times higher than the average rate in World War II. Only after the war settled down, lines stabilized, and the threat of having enemy in the rear areas decreased, did the average rate go down to slightly less than that of World War II. The potential of close-up, inescapable, interpersonal hatred and aggression is more effective and has greater impact on the morale of the soldier than the presence of inescapable, impersonal death and destruction. Hate and psychological inoculation. Martin Seligman developed the concept of inoculation from stress from his famous studies of learning in dogs. He put dogs in a cage that had an electric shock pass through the floor at random intervals. Initially, the dogs would jump, yelp, and scratch pitifully in their attempts to escape the shocks. But after a time, they would fall into a depressed, hopeless state of apathy and inactivity that Seligman termed learned helplessness. After falling into a state of learned helplessness, the dogs would not avoid the shocks even when provided with an obvious escape route. Other dogs were given a means of escape after receiving some shocks, but before falling into learned helplessness. These dogs learned that they could and would eventually escape from the shocks, and after only one such escape, they became inoculated against learned helplessness. Even after long periods of random, inescapable shocks, these inoculated dogs would escape when finally provided with a means to do so. This is a very interesting theoretical concept. But what is important to us is to understand that this process of inoculation is exactly what occurs in boot camps and in every other military school worthy of its name. When raw recruits are faced with seemingly sadistic abuse and hardship, which they escape through weekend passes and ultimately graduation, they are, among many other things, being inoculated against the stresses of combat. Combining an understanding of A, those factors that cause combat trauma, with B, an understanding of the inoculation process permits us to recognize that in most of these military schools, the inoculation is specifically oriented towards hate. The drill sergeant who screams in the face of a recruit is manifesting overt interpersonal hostility. Another effective means of inoculating a trainee against the wind of hate can be seen in U.S. Army and U.S. Marine Corps pugil stick training during boot camp or at the U.S. Military Academy and the British Airborne Brigade, where boxing matches are a traditional part of the training and initiation process. When in the face of all of this manufactured contempt and overt physical hostility, the recruit overcomes the situation to graduate with honor and pride. He realizes, at both conscious and unconscious levels, that he can overcome such overt interpersonal hostility. He has become partially inoculated against hate. I do not believe that military organizations have truly understood the nature of the wind of hate or of the resultant need for this kind of inoculation. It is only since Seligman's research that we have really had the foundation of a clinical understanding of these processes. However, through thousands of years of institutional memory and the harshest kind of survival of the fittest evolution, this kind of inoculation has manifested itself in the traditions of the finest and most aggressive fighting units of many nations. By understanding the role of hate on the battlefield, we now can finally and truly understand the military value of what armies have done for so long and some of the processes by which they have enabled the soldier to physically and psychologically survive on the battlefield.